Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2020 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.
Today on Valley Edition, we'll look at how Fresno County might update its elections and talk to a neighboring county that's already adopted the new model.
And later, we'll go behind the scenes of a new exhibit at Arte Americas. It showcases Latino history in the San Joaquin Valley with maps, photos, paintings, and tells us how the region has been shaped by 300 years of Latin American influence.
But first, air quality. You've heard of cap and trade, which allows companies to buy and sell credits for emitting greenhouse gases. Well, locally, the San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District offers a similar program for other harmful pollutants. But as FM89's Carrie Klein reports, that program is now the focus of a state investigation.
Kevin Hamilton was surprised when he learned that for decades, industries that pollute have been able to trade emissions reductions. It's like a bank. If a company installs a new technology that reduces its pollution, and that's the program's goal, it can earn credits called emission reduction credits, or ERCs. It means they can emit more with no penalty.
And you can trade them. They have value. It's a credit. You get a certificate. It's like a stock certificate.
Hamilton is the CEO of the Central California Asthma Collaborative. And a few years ago, he wanted to know who's getting credits and for how much.
So I started asking, can we see a list of those? And at that time, they couldn't even produce a list for us.
In other words, is the program even working?
I don't know. We can't tell. There's no record.
He and other air quality advocates asked a Washington, D.C. nonprofit called Earthworks to look into the ERC program. After nearly 2 years digging through documents they obtained through the Public Records Act, Earthworks released a scathing report in November. Among other things, it argues the Air District does not have the documentation to back up many of the credits it's issued.
I admit it was worse than I thought it was. I thought there might be some reporting errors. You know, I didn't know quite what, but this is not good.
Some credits have been around for almost 40 years, and the report argues they shouldn't remain valid for so long. Plus, the Air District appears to have granted some credits against the recommendations of its own staff and the EPA. Some of those went to an oil refinery on Bakersfield's Rosedale Highway. It's now idle, but when it was operating, the credits meant it would have been allowed to emit 6 additional tons of pollution every day for decades.
What happened? How do we get there? You know, you're looking at the record thinking, how did this happen? Who did this?
In January, California's Air Resources Board, or CARB, agreed to investigate the program. Michael Benjamin is CARB's chief of air quality planning.
We were very much concerned when we saw the report, and ultimately our board also recognized that there was some issues that needed to be investigated.
He says CARB expects to share its findings in September after reviewing the Air District's credits and how it awards them.
The opacity of the district's banking program is something that we want to be able to better understand. And with any banking program, having a good paper or electronic trail is really important.
Dave Warner is a deputy with the Valley Air District. He says the Earthworks report was too narrow to produce an accurate picture.
It was a lot of correct facts, but incorrect conclusions.
Warner argues ERCs are helping to reduce emissions, but he can't produce data to show that because, he says, ERCs are just one part of a much bigger program. Plus, he says many case studies in the Earthworks report were already approved decades ago.
Those are the same projects that the ARB and EPA gave us Clean Bill of Health in the 1995 audit.
The biggest ERC beneficiaries are oil and gas companies. Kara Siepman with the Western States Petroleum Association says ERCs help that industry grow.
With a banking system in place, businesses are allowed to develop new facilities, and it even brings in new businesses that wouldn't normally be able to operate in the San Joaquin Valley.
That's because the credits they earn when they improve their emissions can be used to save money down the line.
When you're creating new projects, you're creating new jobs. And so the overall economic development of the region is going to increase and at the same time still paying attention to improving air quality.
For instance, major petroleum producer Aera Energy is building the biggest solar farm in the state, which it expects to offset hundreds of thousands of tons of carbon dioxide emissions each year. Over the last two decades, the petroleum industry has generally reduced its emissions at a faster rate than other industries, but not when it comes to particulate matter. For oil and gas, PM2.5 emissions have actually increased, and that has direct implications for asthma attacks, reduced immune function, and cardiovascular problems. With such high stakes, in a region that doesn't meet many federal air quality standards, Kevin Hamilton wonders, should emission reduction credits even exist?
We have nothing to draw credit against. So we are in a deficit spending mode when it comes to air quality.
At the very least, he hopes the state will help the ERC program become a little less hazy. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
California moved its primary election to March. That means the 2020 primary is only a year away. But before that happens, the Fresno County Elections Office plans to update its voting process either by purchasing new machines to replace decades-old technology or by adopting the Voters' Choice Act model. The County Board of Supervisors will make a decision about this today after hearing a recommendation from the county clerk.
Right now, Fresno County utilizes the precinct model, meaning that there are over 268 polling locations throughout the county.
That's Brandy Orth, Fresno County Elections Clerk and Registrar of Voters.
Voters are assigned a specific polling location to go to because their specific ballot will be there.
If you don't go to your polling place, you might miss out on voting in races that affect you locally, like picking your council member, congressman, or local tax measure. But imagine you didn't have to go to a specific polling place. What if you had your pick of 50 places you could vote at as early as 10 days before the election?
You can go anywhere in the county, and we will have your specific ballot there. And you can also do it more according to your schedule. The other thing is that everyone will receive a ballot in the mail.
These are all options under the Voters' Choice Act model. Some say it's more convenient and gives voters more flexibility. That's why Orth is recommending the Board of Supervisors adopt it for the 2020 elections. Just north of Fresno, Madera County has already made the switch. Here's Madera County Clerk Rebecca Martinez.
So this is the drop box. We put a feather flag on it.
The flag is only out when it's time to vote, so it's absent for now. This drop box is outside Martinez's office. With the Voters' Choice Act model, there are four of these in Madera County. This one is simple, white with black text explaining its function in three languages. But Martinez says the others are more colorful, making them stand out.
So the box that we put up in North Fork, we put a flag wrap around it. So it has this red, white, and blue, and it sticks out more than this one does.
In 2018, Madera was one of five counties in the state to adopt the Voters' Choice Act model. And Martinez says the rationale was to give voters more options.
It allows them to make the choice of whether or not they want to vote by mail, whether they want to vote at a vote center, whether they want to drop their ballot in a drop box. And so it provides more opportunity and definitely more days.
One challenge was making sure voters were on the same page about the changes.
We advertised at the movie theater. We advertised at the drive-in, passed flyers out at the swap meet. We did over 50 presentations.
And turnout did increase in the 2018 election compared to Madera County's last midterm. No matter what, Martinez says the same question always comes up. Where do I go to vote? And she says that question will be asked again in 2020. But with the Voters' Choice Act model, there's more than one right answer. And that's something Kingsburg City Council member Jewel Hurtado is looking forward to in Fresno County.
So in 2016, this is where I voted in the general election.
We're sitting outside of Park Kingsburg. It's a retirement community, and it's where Hurtado went to vote when she turned 18.
So that's why I was a little torn when they said it was going to move. I was like, what? No.
The city decided to go from at-large voting to districts last year when Hurtado ran for city council, and her polling place moved downtown. She spent a good chunk of her campaign just explaining this change to her neighbors.
I had a lot of people in my district who said, I work in Fresno. By the time that I get off work and make it to my polling place, which, by the way, which one is that again?
If the Voters' Choice Act model is adopted, she'll have to explain this all over again, but she's hoping the pros outweigh the cons.
It just might be a little bit more convenient for them to go on their lunch or their break or whatever and just get it out of the way and get it done because they know it's important. It's sometimes hard to find that time within that one day.
And with the new model, voters would have at least 10 days in advance to find a voting center and cast their ballot. Fresno County Clerk Brandy Orth is making her recommendation to the board this morning. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
For many adults, the thought of talking in front of a crowd is terrifying. Well, the Peach Blossom Festival at Fresno State helps thousands of elementary school students each year tackle this fear early on by performing and interpreting poems and stories to an audience. Valley Public Radio's Alice Daniel has this audio postcard from a classroom in Dinuba prepping for the festival. It takes place Thursday and Friday.
It was 1976 when Greg Olson first stepped inside his classroom at Lincoln Elementary School in Dinuba. But before he became a teacher,
there's this couple in Reedley, the Olferts, and they started this singing group, and I joined them. And they had us go out and we toured all over Canada and California, and they had us in front of audiences and singing and sharing, and it became, performing became easy. And teachers, you know, you got to perform a little bit.
All that performing, it did something for him, gave him confidence, something he wants to pass on to his students.
Like you did earlier, where you're really making it big. You're going to say...
our full names.
Well, I say mine and then he says
no. I'll say mine.
Maybe introduce both of you and say we're going to do Swami Garam, okay? And then we'll just start like you always do. There you go.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I am Andrew Barajas, and this is my partner,
Aaron Martinez.
And we will be performing for you Swami Garami.
That's why every year, Olson brings as many of his sixth graders as possible to the Peach Blossom Festival.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen.
I'm Swami, and this is my partner, Garami.
Thank you, Swami. Our powers are vast. We've mastered the craft of predicting the past.
We need but seconds for reflection and know exactly what happened a second ago.
My partner, Swami, will now make his first prediction.
As you can hear, they put their own spin on it.
Okay. Every time I climb a tree, we're going to do just small, short things. Every time I climb a tree, quickly. Is that ready? Right here.
Yeah. Okay. Hi, everyone. I'm Elizabeth Tapia. And you know what? Every single time I climb a tree, I scrape my leg or skin my knee. And every time I climb a tree, I find some ants and dodge 1,000,000 bees. Then get the ants all over me every time I climb a tree.
Olson's students practice for weeks, even going from classroom to classroom to perform for other kids.
Though climbing might be good for ants, it awfully isn't good for pants. But climbing is still good for me every time I climb a tree.
Hurry.
The north wall of Olson's sixth grade classroom is plastered with posters that show the eight parts of speech. He's got a song for each one to help the students learn. And on the back wall, there's a class photo from every one of his 43 years here. Rows upon rows of kids with toothy grins or sheepish smiles. And each one of those kids in each one of those classes has had a chance to do this.
Give me a little more volume because you're at a baseball game, the biggest game ever, and you got to act like it's the biggest thing ever. Ready?
My name is Joshua Gomez, and I am doing Casey at bat. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I am Joshua Gomez, your play-by-play announcer, and I'd love to give a huge thanks to our sponsor, Brian, for helping make this broadcast possible. If you have just tuned in, we're at the end of one of the most unbelievable games I've ever experienced, and here's what happened just up until now. The Mudville Nine and the Timber Wolves have been battling at this game for 2 hours straight. The score stands at 4-6 with the Timber Wolves leading and the Mudville Nine now to bat. Here's what happened so far. Two of the Mudville.
In his 4 decades of teaching, Olson has never missed a festival.
What? That ball must have sailed out of the stadium. It's nowhere to be seen. What a hit. What a hit. Wait, the umpire just yelled strike three. Is he kidding? He must be out of his mind.
Sometimes former students will reach out to him to tell him what the festival meant. One student said it gave her courage.
It was just very life-changing for her. That's why I don't want to stop doing this.
Olson has lived in Dinuba all of his life.
My great-great-grandfather was one of the first settlers of Dinuba, Ollie Skeen Wilson. Now, they named the Wilson School after him. Not everybody knows that, but that's the case. So,
a school in town named after his great-great-grandfather. Not a bad family legacy for a man whose work is in the classroom. Oli produced oranges. Greg Olson produces performers.
Wait, what's that in the catcher's mitt? No, it can't be. It can't be. Well, somewhere in this favored land, the sun is shining bright. And somewhere, the band is playing. And somewhere, hearts are light. And somewhere, oh, somewhere, men and women are laughing. And somewhere, children shout. But there is no joy in Mudville, for the mighty Casey has struck out. What a game, what a night. This is Joshua Gomez, and good night from Mudville Stadium.
For Valley Public Radio, I'm Alice Daniel.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. People are living longer compared to decades ago. That fact has spawned a trend: senior citizens taking care of their very elderly parents. As part of our statewide collaboration covering the California Dream, KPBS's Amita Sharma spoke to two sisters in their late 60s who share care of their 100-year-old mom.
It's 3 p.m. on a windy February day in San Diego, and 100-year-old Ginny Davenport, with her smiling eyes and flawless manicure, is excited about the evening ahead.
I hope about 5 o'clock, before the girls leave, that we'll sit down and have a vermouth. That's terrible, isn't it?
The girls, as Ginny calls them, are her daughters. They're 69-year-old Kelly and 67-year-old Riley. Both sisters are married and retired. They both have children. Kelly has a grandchild. And both have taken responsibility for Ginny, as they call her, after their father's recent death. Here's Riley.
We basically share her. So 2 weeks at my house and 2 weeks here at my sister's house. It helps us not get responsibility fatigue, if you will.
At a time in life when 60 or 70-year-old something seniors anticipate retirement and maybe some downtime, some are becoming caregivers and guardians of their parents. No stats exist on how widespread this is, but the trend is expected to intensify.
People are living longer.
University of Southern California gerontology professor Donna Benton says caregiving by younger seniors amid their own aging process has its costs.
For family caregivers, almost 50% report some type of strain or symptoms of depression.
Riley Davenport says for her family, resources and planning are key.
We do have caregivers during the day so that I can work or play or do whatever I am going to do.
The caregivers help Ginny out of bed and bathe her. They take her to doctor's appointments, track her medications. Ginny's older daughter, Kelly, says the sisters considered moving their mom to a senior community.
Neither of us can imagine that it would be the best thing for her and for us, really.
Taking turns with their mom, they learn more about her every day. They recently came across a letter Ginny's first husband, not their father, wrote during World War II.
Saying, you know, I'm going to go on this bombing mission tomorrow. I don't expect to make it home alive. So you go ahead and have a good life. Marry and have kids like we talked about. It won't be with me, but I'm sure you'll find a good man.
Today, Ginny reads novels about that era. There's the romance about a time-traveling World War II nurse.
I'm rereading The Outlander because I like it.
She watches television.
I do like the Golden Girls.
She talks with her daughters about her life and their lives.
I can't think of anything we haven't really shared.
Gerontologist Benton says the Davenport story is atypical when it comes to seniors caring for their elderly parents. Too often, families don't have the relationships or resources or health to age together so gracefully. But when they do, it's ideal.
It does allow for everyone to grow throughout their lifetime.
Ginny says living with her daughters couldn't be more comfortable.
They're part of me, having grown up with them. And I'm still growing up with them. That doesn't sound right, but that's what it's like.
In San Diego, I'm Amita Sharma.
This story is part of our statewide California Dream collaboration.
A new exhibit at Arte Americas in downtown Fresno looks at the history of Latinos in the San Joaquin Valley from the 1700s to present day. I spoke with the executive director of the Fresno Arts Council, Lilia Chavez, about what visitors can expect.
The exhibit Caminos, Latino History of the Central Valley, is a portrait of the migration of Latinos in the Central Valley. So let's take a walk and see what we have here. I think the term Caminos is very appropriate for this exhibition because we actually see in this first section of the exhibit a map that shows the migration of people coming across in California, and you can see different locations where people settled. And this was in the early 1700s when people were first arriving into this area. And at that time, it was primarily Spanish and or Mexican people that were settling in this area. As we move further, you see other maps that show who were the people that inhabited California. And at that time, in the early days, it was known as Alta California. And so you can see a listing of all of the early Spanish governors, Mexican governors of California, and then the native people that inhabited this area.
And what kind of Native American tribes were here in the valley?
You can see that there were the Wintu people, the Miwok, the Menachi, the Maidu, the Yana, the Yokuts, the Yahi, and many others. We move through the exhibition, and I think it's important to note that maps are an important part of this exhibit because it does show people began to migrate and come to California.
Yeah, there's so much information here, it seems, and so many maps and kind of, you know, these colorful pictures to go along with it.
Right. When we look at then the Gold Rush period in California, it was significant to the Central Valley as well because as people from the East came, we talk about the land grabs and how property changed hands. There was a period during the Gold Rush where there was certainly not enough gold to go around for everyone. And so those people that came began to settle and do other things. And as they did other things, they began to push out many of the Mexicanos that were here, with the exception of those individuals that had particular talents that they found valuable. And so we go into this other period where we see that agriculture became very important to the Central Valley.
You know, this quote really stands out to me over here. It says, "We didn't cross a border, the border crossed us." Can you kind of explain that a little bit more?
Prior to the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, there was no border. People migrated freely north and south in Alta California to Baja California. So there really was no restrictions of people moving back and forth. The exhibit then takes you into the 1900s, and the road to the north, or Los Caminos al Norte, And you see that during the Mexican Revolution, there was a huge migration of people that came from Mexico to the United States. And that happened for many different reasons. When there's wars, you know, often people flee and look for places where they might have better opportunities.
So now we're at Seeds of Change.
Right. This section called Seeds of Change, 1940s to 1950s, is very much related to what occurred after World War II when people came back from the war or they were here during the war. And so this talks about that. It talks about the kind of entertainment, the music, the traditions, the cultural events as Mexicanos continued to settle in California.
Cool. So a lot of these photos were actually taken in Fresno.
Yeah, all of these photos are from the Central Valley, either Fresno or some other location in the Central Valley. We then also need to recognize that another thing that occurred that brought many Mexicans back to California was the Bracero program. And the Bracero program, again, was aligned with agriculture. During the war, many people left, and the farms still had to be maintained and operated. And so the United States brought in people from Mexico. And many of the Braceros remained. They didn't go back. They stayed here and raised their families. As we move into this section, then we look at the migrant farm worker experience. Again, after the Bracero period and during, there was a way of life that people had during their farm worker experience. And so here are a series of pictures that share that.
And can you kind of explain what some of these pictures look like?
You can see that there are certainly family pictures. There were pictures of homes. Anyone who has read The Grapes of Wrath certainly has seen kind of what migrant camps look like. And this is very similar. It was the same experience that was occurring with the Mexican migrant workers. And these photographs were done by George Ballas, who was very involved in the early farm worker movement and who followed the farm workers and took pictures of their living environment. The next section of the exhibit is still a work in progress. It's called El Movimiento. El Movimiento then takes us into the 60s and the 70s during the Chicano movement, during a political upheaval, and a time of rebirth and recognition for many Chicanos, Mexican Americans, who felt that it was time now for us to have an equal place at the table in California. And when I talk about the table, I mean, you know, the table of politics, the table of health care, the table of civil rights, that there it was important for us to be active participants in order to elevate and provide opportunity for the next generation.
I also talked to one of the designers of this exhibit, Tony Carranza. So it seems like it's kind of more of like telling this really big story through maps, through paintings, yeah, through a lot of photographs, through even newspapers.
Yeah. You know, for this project, there was not only a lot of people working on the show, there's tons of contributors would come in, they would bring photos, they would give their stories about their family history, their grandfathers, their grandmothers, where they are now, the origins of how they became to come to the Valley. All that played out through the show.
What do you think would surprise us about Latino culture here in the Valley, or like the migration of Latinos?
Yeah, you know, a lot of people, and that's the thing that we thought that it was important for people to know just how long our people have been here, the way California developed, the way the U.S. developed.
What effect do you hope that people have after seeing this exhibit?
I would hope that they would come away with a new appreciation of what has been built here, how our families and our ancestors have come here. You know, a lot of times, you know, some of these things that are quote unquote Latin get commercialized, and you're known for some, you know, Chihuahua with a taco eating a taco or something, right? Sure. So, but there's so much more, and there's such deeper roots and beautiful history here that I would hope that people would walk away really enlightened and wanting to learn more.
And now let's pivot back to education. How do teachers even become interested in teaching? How do districts recruit them? And what goes into trying to hire teachers that reflect the diversity of Valley classrooms? Today in the studio, moderator Kathleen Schock speaks with Tamala Riot, a photography teacher who just won Fresno Unified's High School Educator of the Year, Laura Alamillo, interim dean of the Kremen School of Education at Fresno State, and Tiffany Samuel, who works in teacher development for Fresno Unified.
So, Tamala, let's start with you and your journey specifically about how you came to the classroom, which is a story that is probably not what we think of as traditional.
No, it's not. It's a little off-putting to some people until they hear the end. I went through a divorce 20 years ago, and because I'm type 1 diabetic, I needed medical benefits. I had been working as a commercial photographer here in Fresno and had a nice client base, but I would not make enough money to afford me medical insurance. In fact, at the time, I was an automatic decline. So I was scrambling, and I happened to have toured Sunnyside as it was being built and was given a business card by the assistant principal at the time, Cheryl Weaver. And she just thought, wow, you would be a great fit with our kids. I saw a dark room that blew my mind. It was better than anything I'd ever stepped into because I come from a traditional background of black and white film photography. And upon the breaking up of my relationship, I made the phone call. I kept that card and made the phone call. I never thought in a million years I would want to work with kids, be a teacher. And she said, we can get you a credential in 1 year, and that's when we're going to open our electives at our school. We would love to have you on board.
And you had a bachelor's degree, which enabled that opportunity,
exactly,
right?
Yes.
That's fantastic. Tiffany, you work every day to recruit teachers like Tamala. Is this, you know, when I said this is an untraditional story, is that even true?
We have several people who are unaware of the benefits of teaching and can go into teaching through an alternative program such as Tamala. But the truth of the matter is we see cases like Tamala every day, and it does seem to be as if it is different because it's not the normal pathway into teaching. But Fresno Unified provides so many supports for people who have a bachelor's degree in any subject area that have a passion for teaching, a passion for kids, and we can get them into the classroom.
Dr. Alamillo, Fresno State is such a key part of developing that teacher pipeline in the Central Valley. Tell us a little bit about what is happening at Fresno State and how the university contributes to developing new teachers.
Well, right now we're really embarking on a new way of looking at teacher preparation, and we're establishing a lot of Grow Your Own initiatives where we're looking at the community and people from the community to really get into the teacher pathway and become teachers in the region that we're serving. And so many of the programs we have, one of them is our teacher residency, which we have a strong partnership with Fresno Unified, where we recruit teachers to work in classrooms from day one. Our teacher residency model is very successful. It's getting national recognition because what we see is that not only are the teachers performing well, but the children in the classrooms where teachers are being placed are performing well as alongside with those future teachers. And so our teacher residency program looks at placing our candidates in elementary classrooms from the first day children arrive in August, September, until the very last day that they leave in May or June. And so we are continuing that. We are also, we have a residency program with Sangre Unified. We have one also with Central. And what's really unique about our residencies is that they each have a theme. And so, for example, Fresno, our residency focuses on STEM, whereas in Central, we're beginning one that's focused on socio-emotional learning. We're also developing one with Clovis that's more on culturally sustaining pedagogy. And
can you unpack what that means?
Yes. So basically, what we know is that when residents are exposed to innovative practices like universal design for learning, if we focus on aspects that are that children are experiencing in relation to socio-emotional learning, in relation to their identity, we know that we need to prepare teachers to also know how to work with children that may be experiencing difficulties. And so a lot of our curriculum is focused on with a lens of looking at issues of identity, mental health. We make sure that faculty are well prepared to answer questions when it comes to those specific areas. We also are starting a more clearly defined pathway from the community colleges. And so we are starting a initiative with Fresno City and Reedley College, where we are looking at that pathway from transfers into our liberal studies and into our credential program. And that's an HSI federal grant. And it's called Abriendo Puertas. And so that will start in the fall.
That's
well,
exciting.
We've already started, but the cohorts will begin in the fall.
That's fantastic. Yeah. So, Tiffany, tell us a little bit about some of the goals that Fresno Unified has in terms of recruiting, specifically as it pertains to diversity.
Well, right now, Fresno Unified, our goal is to allow for our teacher population to reflect our student population. And when we look at diversity and recruitment, we look at two different things. One is our teacher pipeline. Right now, we have a pipeline of over 300 aspiring teachers and it reflects a diversity rate of 74%. So we have these people who are being introduced to pedagogy, who are developing in the skill set so that we can place them into the classroom. And they're not yet placed, but they're continuing to be groomed so that they can get into that classroom. But then we also look at our current teacher population, which does not yet reflect the 74% diversity of the pipeline. However, as those teachers or aspiring teachers who are in the pipeline transition into the teaching, into the classroom, then we'll actually increase our minority population and allow it to reflect the population of students and who we teach.
Now, Tamela, I'd love to hear what you have to say about why diversity matters in the classroom as somebody who's there every day on the front lines working with kids.
Right. I believe part of why I was recruited by Cheryl Weaver 20 years ago, when Sunnyside was open, is she was finding the top-notch educators in Fresno Unified, as well as matching the types of people that kids could relate to. And my tour was with my then wife, who was a doctor in our community, and we were building a doctor's academy at Sunnyside High School. So I believe, you know, with no educational background except I was a photographer, the fact that I was in a lesbian relationship, I was relatable to some of the kids who didn't have anybody to connect with. And albeit I never started a GSA club on campus, I never hid my relationships. And I don't need to wave a flag, but I'm open. And at Sunnyside, I have not known any student to be picked on because they are gay, lesbian, or transgendered. So I think it's really important, and I believe Sunnyside does a great job, and I teach at Sunnyside High School, matching the types of people that our community is.
Absolutely. So if you're just joining us, this is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock, and I'm here speaking with a panel of educators about what it takes to be a great teacher and recruit new teachers to this profession. So, Dr. Alamillo, you bring a really unique perspective to this conversation, given that you started working with kids in the classroom and then have gone on to a career in higher education and as an academic researcher. And, of course, much of your research focus looks at diversity in the classroom. but not just racial and cultural diversity, but also linguistic diversity, which is something that is particularly important here in the Central Valley. Can you speak a little bit about the research that you've done and why it's so important?
So I think what Tamala brings up, I think, a really good point, that when we look at issues of diversity, we need to expand that. And it's not solely looking at culture. It's racially, linguistically. When we look at how children identify themselves, whether it be LGBTQ or whether they identify as transgender. And what we know is that the curriculum also has to match children's experiences. And so diversity can be not only addressed by the teacher in the classroom, which is really important, but it can also be addressed by the type of literature teachers use, by the type of field trips they engage in, by bringing families into the classroom. And so being a teacher that meets the needs of your student should also, it would be beneficial if teachers also reflect on the type of curriculum that they're using. And so some of my work looks specifically at literature and how teachers identify the type of literature that they use in the classroom and how they critically analyze if that literature is relevant to their kids, if it's accurate, if it's authentic, if they're actual authentic, accurate authors that are depicting those experiences. And, you know, I was at a recruiting at a church 2 weekends ago because we at Fresno State in our teacher prep program, the one area that we are needing to improve is the presence of African-American males. And that's an area that is across the nation an issue where we need to find more ways to recruit Black males into the classroom. The pipeline is one way, but we know now that we have to go to the places where some of these communities are practicing their cultural or, you know, everyday practices. And it was really interesting to speak at a church I had never been, you know, to. And it was very engaging, and I really loved it. One thing I talked about was that one teacher that made an impression on me in high school. And that was a teacher who was of color and who brought in Toni Morrison's Bluest Eye. And I had never read that book. I was like, what is this? You know, and that's really the one book that I remember in my high school experience. And so I talked a little bit about how teachers can make an impact on children at a very young age. And some of that means to bring in literature that reminds those kids of who they are and of their cultural experiences.
And valuing the background that they bring with them to
exactly.
the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
Tiffany, from where you sit, are we experiencing a teacher shortage? Is this a crisis? Or is it specific to certain areas?
That's a hard question to answer. From where I sit, yes, I do believe that we're experiencing a teacher shortage. But I believe so. In just thinking about the previous answers, it's because most people who do have a bachelor's degree and have a passion to teach, they don't realize how they can become a teacher, that there's various pathways into teaching, that there's various programs that can service them to get into teaching. I think about the African-American male, and Fresno Unified is going into churches and advertising how if you have a passion and you have a skill set and can bring an experience, please do so. We are partnering with the universities and going into sports events and athletic arenas in order to get the word out. You can become a teacher. So I do believe there is a shortage in teachers, but if people were more aware of the opportunities that they can that are out there to become a teacher and the supports that being provided, for example, Fresno Unified, we service from students on anyone who's interested in teaching. We start at the student level, and we have programs that are available for people with a bachelor's degree in any subject area, programs for people who are interested in getting a master's degree while attending a teaching credentialing program, programs for people who don't have a bachelor's degree and don't know where to start. We have test preparation programs, all of these services that are being offered, but people are unaware. So just in the desire to stop the shortage and minimize that shortage that is national that people do have, we are doing so many supports and offering so many supports to try to get people to Fresno Unified and just get people to teaching as a whole.
A question I'll open up to anyone, because I think you all offer or would bring a different perspective to it. But to what extent is the perception that teachers are underpaid preventing folks from looking at this as a career? And not to say that I would argue that point, especially given how important teachers are to our society. But in actuality, according to the National Education Association, average salaries for teachers in California hover right around $77,000 a year, which is more than a lot of people I know make who have bachelor's degrees. So is it a matter of compensation or is it something else?
I'll be glad to speak to that. I feel that I'm adequately paid for what I do. However, the teacher's heart, you take your work home, you're working 24 hours a day. And I should just say I'm speaking for myself. And to back up, to tell you, when I said I never wanted to work with kids, after 2 years in the classroom, I found my calling in this world, and it is what I was meant to do. I absolutely love the work that I get to do every day. And when you look at the calendar year, we work 185 days and are paid for those, but we get a paycheck year round, and along with good benefits. So when you look at the time that we have off and that we're paid for, we're getting paid well. There are extra jobs that we take on. We take our work home. And I think the perception has changed because we're all working harder with technology. Technology has changed my life. I have so many emails to respond to. I have so many meetings that I need to sit in on and then report back on outside of the classroom, and the preparation for engaging students with meaningful projects and learning takes quite a bit of time.
Absolutely.
So again, I think it is perception. Bottom line is I get a good paycheck. I get time off. I can utilize however I want, and I've chosen to use it to better my teaching practices.
And you were recently named High School Teacher of the Year by Fresno Unified. So congratulations for that honor.
Thank you.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock here with a panel of educators talking about what it means to be a teacher today. Tiffany, I would love to hear your thoughts about what are some of the misunderstood aspects of teaching? What do people get wrong when they think about what it means to be a great teacher? I'll let you think about that for a second. And I also, as part of that, would love for you to talk a little bit about the work that you do to retain teachers. I know the first year in the classroom can be a tough one. So what is Fresno Unified doing to support teachers in that first year?
Well, we have a comprehensive approach to support. We offer an induction program in which we have full release coaches that are there to support any of our new teachers along the way. Those people on short-term staff permits who don't necessarily have a teaching credential but are in the classroom, as well as any of the new teachers who onboard for Fresno Unified, this is their voyage, I'll say, their maiden voyage in actually teaching. So we have those full release coaches, as well as the administrators supporting them. Any program coordinator, such as myself, I coordinate the transition to teaching program, so I'm out there supporting. There are layers of support, test preparation, websites that we offer, free trainings that we offer, the presentations that we offer, and conferences to help increase their skill set. So we offer various supports to assist them.
Dr. Alamio, before we wrap up, I'd love to hear a bit about a term that you introduced me to, which is emergent bilingual, as opposed to what we would traditionally think of as an English language learner or English as a second language. Can you speak to why that reframing is so important and some of the efforts that Fresno Unified is taking to recruit folks who are Spanish speakers or speak other languages other than English?
I mean, what we're trying to do in teacher preparation is really reexamine and redefine some of even the terms we're using to identify children. And the state of California uses the term English learners to identify children who are learning English as a second language. But what the research shows is that terms such as English learners, even though those are state adopted terms, some of those terms may present some deficit notions of what it means to be a second language learner. And so what we do in teacher preparation is that we present to candidates, these are the terms that the state uses, and often districts use this term, but we really have to disrupt some of those terms. And emergent bilingual seems to present a more additive way of approaching bilingualism and multilingualism in the classroom. And in working with our partnership districts, they're very open to even adopting some of those terms and how they define or identify children in the classroom. And so the term emergent bilingual looks at a more dynamic way of language, whereas we know that English learners, even though they are testing in a certain manner when it comes to English proficiency, they're still very often maintaining their first language and speaking their primary language in the home with their parents, grandparents, and in the playground. And so it's just a more additive way Absolutely. Of looking at multilingualism.
Framing their language skills as a positive as opposed to a negative or a deficit when they enter into the classroom.
Or that they're having to let go. And we really, what we know that when we look at issues of identity, children should not let go of anything when they enter a classroom.
Wonderful. So before we wrap up, Tamala, I would just love to hear what advice you might have for somebody who may be considering a career in teaching, particularly somebody, let's say, in your position, who was a professional, who might be considering a change of career path.
It's an amazing journey. I continually learn about the world and myself, and I grow far. I believe I've grown so much further as an instructor of the realm in which I was trained as a photographer than I ever would have as just a commercial or professional photographer. So I get to stay at the top of my field knowing what I need to share with my students and yet grow as a human being because I'm constantly interacting with our youth and our community. It just has enriched my life. So I encourage anybody who's feeling a need to make a shift to consider taking your expertise into the classroom. And it's not that difficult. There are programs like Tiffany and Laura have explained to get you ready to be a phenomenal teacher. Our kids need you.
That sounds like a perfect place to stop. Thank you all for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can find all this and more on our website, kvpr.org, or download the podcast. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Valley Public Radio and on Twitter at KVPR.
Did you know we have an app? It's called KVPR, and it's available for free in app stores on iTunes and Android. This show is produced by me, my co-host Monica Velez, and reporters Carrie Klein and our news director Alice Daniel. Our audio engineer is Marv Allen, and Don Weaver is our production and operations manager. I'm Laura Satsui.
And I'm Monica Velez. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2020 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.